This is CliffCentral.com.
Well, that's us on Black Life. We're here. How are you guys doing? We're busy talking here in the studio about so many other things. We're like not even listening.
Yes, sir. It's Black Life. Hello to me show.
Hello, Mona BC. How you doing, buddy?
I'm all right, and you, buddy?
I'm good, man. You know, so many things are happening this week that it's just like, again.
Yeah.
How like, do you feel? Let's start with we got our guests in the studio today.
Well,
we're going to have some
interesting
topics.
Do you call them topics. Guests? I guess, call them gate crashers.
Is it gate crashers?
Yeah, decided
to come and join us.
Yeah. Our weekly gate crashers.
Let me get some bed music up in there.
Yeah. Dimisha's a bit delayed today. It's almost like it's his Friday. Boss, what's going on? You're going to run the desk properly.
You know what it is, right? It's that song that was playing in the background and then you telling me about all these other things that are happening. People getting fined, monies, Gareth's issue with Mnet.
Hey!
Him having to sue them for 25 mil.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of... Gareth, you know, can you just like increase our salaries?
Can I get on that bandwagon with you, Gareth? Just for 1 million. That's all. That's like more than what they've paid me in my lifetime. Working for them. He's going to get it one time.
And you slaved for Mnet, huh?
A slave, man. You know, I watch Saints and Sinners and sometimes I'm a little bit bitter that this show is in its second season and the money I was paid was like, it kind of paid the bills for 1 month, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, after the tax man takes his cut, you still have to find other work.
Like, and, no, and all those cookouts, because I mean, you know, the day you get money, Dumisho cooks out. Eh?
Like, no, the day I get money, you know it, because I'm spending it.
Yeah. That's the one thing I like.
The thing is, it's not that much, you know. So when
bondi.
You spent it, it's like that's it. But anyway, in the studio today, we've got Kurtesh Sanderson, and we're going to be talking about if you have, you're thinking of. We spoke about alternative lifestyles last time. If you're thinking of having an alternative lifestyle when it comes to your work life.
Right.
If you're thinking of either staying in corporate or leaving corporate, what are some of the things that you need to look out for? We're also going to be talking about the Yasin Bey issue. That's most deaf to people who don't know his African name, I guess, with Brooklyn. How you doing, buddy?
Doing great.
Yeah, that's good. And him, I don't know, what's going on there? He got kicked out of the country or he's being held in prison? What's up with that?
He's got kicked out of the country, but he's held in prison right now. He's going to be on trial in March. And the issue is that he's using a world passport. So I think it's important to discuss what a world passport validates.
Because our famous Home Affairs Minister came up and said there is no world passport.
Yeah.
Now, I Googled that.
Is there a world passport?
Turns out it exists.
It does exist.
Okay. Kurtesh, have you heard of a world passport, by the way?
Not really, hey? I always was very specific, country specific. And when I first looked at it, I thought, wow, look at that.
Oh, you saw the picture?
Well, obviously when the story broke and you're considering world passports, I first of all thought it was some kind of scam that you get this world passport. It's almost like a world order somewhere.
Yeah.
Who is this world and where do they...
Well, it's recognized in about 180 countries.
Well, it's important to make sure that the country you're going to recognize it too, surely.
Yeah. And the challenge for him is the bloop is that he's now denounced his American citizenship. So where do you send him? And over that side, Brooklyn, correct me if I'm wrong, he's also got a court matter that's pending for him that side.
Yeah,
child maintenance.
Yep.
Oh my goodness, he's in a little bit of trouble there.
Just a little.
Just on the side, I mean, if you're talking about a world passport, I'm sure many South Africans are sitting out there saying, well, can I get one? And which country can I emigrate with that passport with?
Exactly. Those 180 countries. I hope they're cool countries.
Yeah, like, because I definitely didn't know something like that existed.
Tanzania is one of them.
Okay.
Ecuador is another.
Okay. Guatemala.
Guatemala, if you feel
I
like
saw
going
Guatemala.
There.
See, all those countries, what you're talking about is if you're rich, it's okay to go there.
Pretty much.
But if you're like us and you move to Tanzania, it's going to be a little bit tough.
Who's us?
You
speak know? For yourself.
Me, you.
No, speak for yourself.
Brooklyn.
I don't know about you.
Kurtesh, though. Kurtesh can move anywhere he likes. Yeah. But the rest of us, like, you go to Tanzania
Kurtesh,
or Ecuador.
You need to school your boy here.
You go to Ecuador.
I do. I don't know what he's seeing or what he's reading.
If you went to Tanzania, my guy, I think you'd be selling peanuts on the side of the road.
True story.
Like the rest of us.
True story.
It's like
to the tourists. selling peanuts dollar, to tourists.
To the South African dollar, tourists, right?
Yeah, straight up. You know, like how we had Black Coffee and he was, yeah, he was declaring his dollar status.
He didn't declare that. You declared it. You said that he was a dollar million. He was like, well, you know, maybe SARS was listening that day.
He didn't say no. So neither no.
He didn't quite say or, yes.
What do you mean?
He didn't say yes. I am a dollar millionaire. He was like, yeah, well, you know.
So that if you're saying, if you're not refusing a statement, it means it's a yes.
I suppose, but it, it could mean go. That you so just we'll don't want to say yes. Assumption. You're just saying it's around there, but you know, I don't want SARS to know exactly how much.
Yeah.
Or it means it could be. I'm totally embarrassed to say it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe it's a lot more. Like, oh, you only heard about the $1. Yeah. I've actually got like another five stashed somewhere.
You know, it's really difficult. I'm trying to think of all those people who are relocating to New Zealand, Australia. You know, those 10th and 11th province of SA.
And London. That's another province, by the way.
No, that one you divide by 14 to 16. Hey, yeah, but what is it now? 16, immigrate. Hey?
What? No, the 24.
24.
What?
Yeah, somewhere down there. It's trading 23,
24,
yeah.
What?
Real.
That's really hard to compete.
It's a lot of money.
So like, if you've got like 2.4 million, right? And then you go to the UK, yeah. Right.
You've got, what? What is that? You do the math.
240,000.
240,000.
No, it's
no less, less half, less. Half of that.
You've got what? 100
a quarter. And so you've got a quarter, which is
£100,000.
What's that?
If no. You've got 2.4 million rands,
2.4 divided by 24 makes it 10. So you've got
600,000. That's how much you'd have.
600,000 what? Pounds.
Pounds, yeah.
Hey. No, let's do the maths properly, hey, guys. Why we talk about
let's
that?
Let's just.
I got a magazine from a good friend of mine, Teppo. The British GQ magazine is quite thick and it's really expensive and all that. And they don't mess around in that magazine in terms of
100,000.
The fashion.
100,000 pounds.
Okay.
Yes, right. So I was right. Whatever. 24. Absolutely.
I was right.
Your maths is better than mine.
Well, you know, I'm very good when it comes to money. Don't make me like do geometry things like that. But I was. I'm just saying, like, when you look at the cost of things. The international men's magazines have all this fashion, they have all this furniture. I mean, there was a paperweight for like 60, was it 65 pounds or 695 pounds? I'm not sure. But when you do that kind of calculation and you're buying a paperweight and it's going to cost you basically 12,000 rands, you just go, okay, maybe I should just stay here. You know, you look at the fashion that they have in those kind of magazines. They've got the Louis Vuittons. What's that car brand? The most expensive car in the world. Starts with a B. I've forgotten it now.
Bugatti.
Bugatti's actually got a fashion range and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Polo Loren makes furniture. There was a chair for £7,000 for your office.
Yeah.
Now, that chair is basically what? 160,000 rands to just sit. I hope it helps you do calculations.
Straight up.
Yeah, no. It's a lot. I think when you actually do the calculations like you're doing now or you travel there, it's serious money. Serious. The difference is huge now.
But it's always good if you're earning in that money and you're living in South Africa.
Yeah. Look, the perfect thing is that scenario, is that if you're earning in pounds and you live in a low cost economy like South Africa, I think that's the ideal scenario. Yeah. But how do you actually do that is quite difficult.
Could you export a lot of South African stuff? I mean, one of the things, we're going to talk about appropriating African culture for one. I know that there are a lot of people who go out there and buy crafts, you know, from rural areas. And then they basically create a legend or a myth around them, which is basically what you need to sell artwork, right? They give the international guys a certificate to say, this is the person who made it, was made in such a country, and it costs you only £1,000 for one of these pieces. Meantime, he bought one of those pieces for like 100 rand.
True story.
From the lady who makes baskets in rural KZN. Is that maybe not like actually appropriating our own culture?
People
and
do
taking
that.
Taking it out there.
People do
because
that.
Other people are doing it for us at the moment.
Yeah.
I think we've got to. The key thing is to find people who are doing that. Obviously, understand the market overseas, and then they come back and look for products that they can source and sell. I think you're 100% right. The opportunity is there for us to export. I think that's the industries that's going to make the most. Those that have to import, obviously, it's the other way around. But I agree with you. There is. The question is that the world, somebody who's producing something, always looks at the world around him and doesn't really understand what the potential opportunity is in London. I mean, I look at it all the time. I'm a consultant, live in South Africa, think I should be offering consulting skills in London. But the reality is that that is very difficult for somebody to buy those from you in those markets because you don't have a track record. So,
right.
So I think a product's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
So if you made something and somebody sees it, and I think now with the internet, with the web, with whatever, that is a possibility.
Well, here's the thing with what you're talking about. You said the internet and the web. I got a call yesterday from a gentleman in India, and they make apps and they make websites.
Fake.
Well, the thing is,
they hit you with a delayed accent. Good day, Mr. Tamisha Marsha.
But the thing is this. What I'm trying to say is
fake.
There's Indian companies that are making websites in South Africa.
Yeah,
you know what
true
I mean?
Story.
Whether those true you get that story. Website made or not, the fact of the matter is you can actually even export services
you
that
can.
You never
yeah,
thought were possible.
Yeah.
Because someone like in your position as a consultant,
absolutely.
I'm sure if you look at medium-sized enterprises in the UK, and you're consulting. So basically, you are helping them either get their systems going, their accounting going, or whatever it is that they need, as long as you can deliver on that, as long as you can understand the laws in that side of the world, especially when it comes to tax laws, you could be making thousands of pounds.
Absolutely.
And all you need is
let me tell you something. The thought of that crosses my mind often. I look
have
at
no
it
doubt.
And I try and work out these strategies how to get pounds out of a lot of British people. But the reality is that you're going to have the same reaction like you had. I mean, there was a reaction, it's fake, it's this. Is that when you try and market to somebody overseas, the first reaction is you got to get over the trust hurdle.
Yeah.
As is this a real company? Mm. Can they actually deliver?
Mm.
Or am I just going to pay my £100 as this initial fee or commitment fee? And then they're gone.
Yeah.
And
never
that's,
see them
that's
again,
the
right?
really, really part that you can't get people over the hurdle because of that real trust issue. So the next point is then, well, you got to have somebody in that location.
Region, with the regional office.
Correct, with the regional office who maybe is a face and which somebody buying services can trust and builds a bit of a track record. I think once you've done it a couple of times and people start talking about it, of how they're actually saved by using you, then you're away. I think the beginning is the hardest part.
Because if you think about it, if you offered your services at a quarter of the price that people are paying in the UK, you'd be making so much more than what you'd be charging in South Africa. You know, let's say your services to a medium-sized company are £5,000 for, I don't know, how many is that, a month, a year?
Could be a year, depending what services you were talking about. I mean, if you're an accountant or someone of that nature and there was an annual fee, you could be £5,000.
Let's say £10,000 then for that year. You've already just made 240,000 rands. Boom, just like that.
Correct. So the maths works. Okay. the rest of it works. We are in a low cost base now. It's become an issue where previously, I mean, if you look at global economy, China was cheaper. India is doing exactly the same things, exporting skills and obviously through outsourcing or through providing web services or whatever. South Africa could be in that exact position.
It's a matter of skills, though, isn't it?
It is a matter of skills, but it's also a matter of marketing the destination. So I think if I was in government and we had this huge differential, we should be putting our best foot out there and saying, well, we are now a destination for things to happen. I mean, the one industry that's done particularly well here is the call center industry. I don't know if you've been to Durban lately, but there are lots of fancy buildings, and a lot of those buildings are call centers because timing works for Europe. We are similar time as they are. Language, we can
works.
Speak English clearly.
Yes.
And a lot of the way we do things mimics the European way. So there is that that element. It's about selling. I think you create trust if you marketed South Africa and its services overseas. Once you have a trusted source or a trusted way of doing things, once people have experienced it, in other words, somebody has bought something from you, they're very happy and they sell it on, I think then there's a huge opportunity for export of services. But products, if we were productive, if we could produce things as efficiently, I mean, China's becoming expensive, but if we were producing things that are useful at a reasonable cost, which we can do now, there is an argument to revive manufacturing in not everything. in certain areas where we can be perhaps niche players and produce things for Europe.
Now, Katesh, I've got, there's been a huge argument around Black Magazine and the social media stuff that we've been putting out to say, you know, there's a lot of people appropriating fashion within our fashion space, where they're taking, for example, Marion Fassler. I mean, take us through that.
They're taking Marion Fassler and doing what? What
do you mean? No. Let Brooklyn take us through that, because social media has been buzzing.
What's happening?
It's been a case of, we put out the story about the fact of cultural appropriation, which goes back to the service that what you're speaking about, like providing these services. But then when exploitation of those services are being, they're not being zoned in from like locals of our country, and they're being exploited by other people, that becomes an issue. So social media has been buzzing, saying we're glad that this is being raised and that this situation is being spoken about. But there are other people who are defending it. They're just like, why is it cultural appropriation? Why can't we do this? Why, as African people, we're appropriating Western culture? So I think it's a difficult position that we're in, even in marketing services and trade.
Do you think we could be more specific about what it is that was actually appropriated?
So, in this regard, we're speaking about the appropriation of fashion.
Okay.
And how in... So there's this lady, a white lady, who's making African garments by African tribes and then selling it to a European market.
Okay.
And the European market aren't understanding the nature and the authenticity of where these garments are from, other than it's from Africa. So there's this form of exoticism that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem is, why is this going on? Why are we allowing it? Because we're essentially exploiting, like, Africa.
Isn't that, like, going back to what Katesh was talking about in terms of a trust? You've built a name, or you're credible, or the fact is, just to be, like, frank, I'm living in Europe, I'm white, and a white person sells me something from Africa, I'll probably believe whatever they say, like I was talking about, because they've created a legend that, oh, this particular fabric was made by these people and blah, 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 and, you know, it's very special because it was used in ceremonies. When I tell them that, they're like, okay, whatever. But when I've got this white person saying that, it's like, oh, that sounds interesting, because you would know. You know art, you know history, you know all those things. What you were saying just now, I think we should start playing the game. Why not then? Because I've been thinking about it, even in my industry. One of the best things to do, honestly, is to say, I am going to be the head of this company. I'm going to do the strategy, the vision, I'm going to run it. But I'm going to employ either a white male or a white female to actually be my face of this company. Because quite frankly, when you talk to other white people, they will listen. When you talk to black people, they will listen just as much. But if it's just you coming up and saying all these things, it's almost like you have to prove yourself and prove yourself again. It's we don't want to do politics again, because we're always doing politics on the show. But isn't that the same thing with Chris Hart? The guy got away with being one of the biggest economics speakers in the country with only barely a matric. And here you are sitting with all these qualifications. I don't think Standard Bank ever called you and said, hey, listen, would you like to head up the economy side of our bank?
I think the one thing we have to learn, and it's I grapple with the same question all the time, is you know, the way the economy works and the way the world works, unfortunately, has there's certain norms, standards, and expectations that people have. And yes, we have to push individual identities, we have to push all of that. But at the end, when one looks at it, and one has to coalface, take people out of everything, and if you had to do a strategy on the board, coalface, you will sit back and say, well, I'm targeting a particular market. That particular market buys in a certain way.
Mm.
And this is how it works, right? So either I've got two choices. Do I try and buck what I've seen and trend? Or do I try and structure my company in a way to take advantage of an opportunity? And that strategy does that all the time.
Yeah. I think we have
a background where people are trying to obviously rise above, create an identity for yourself, sell your skills for who you what you've developed and how you've done it. I think we have to develop more confidence. I think we have to almost believe in ourselves and what we have to offer, and actually stand up and shout it. A lot of times, the people that have all the skill all the know-how. Just don't know how to get that message across. It's not normal for you to stand out and say, I am the best.
Yeah.
Especially in this country.
You know what I mean? You're always saying, well, I'm learning, I'm busy developing my skill, I'm doing all these things. So what should I really be doing? You've actually got to stand up there and say, I'm the best. And you've got to believe in what you're saying. And at no point will you ever be in a position to know everything, right? But you will know something that you can actually... you know, actually sell and actually put out there.
Well, the thing is, right, and you were about to say something there, Brooklyn, that was going to be interesting to add to the conversation.
Yeah, is that someone as who sees the trend, who sees the market and sees that there's an opportunity, I think what the problem with those people is that they have to have some form of moral high ground as to there needs to be, there's currently an imbalance of power. There's an imbalance of power of these exploited communities, and then there's an imbalance in terms of these people that are appropriating this. So I think it is important that the people who have the imbalance do rise up, but they're not being educated. They're not being taught that you can do this. They're not being shown the ways to rise up and take their own skill and share it with the world and say that you do have a voice. Even if your voice is your trade, you don't need to verbally speak. But then when those people who misrepresent them, that's a major problem.
I think it's a wonderful thing that you've just said. But sometimes I think it's a bit idealistic. I think why not go with what it is that the world expects? I remember when I started working at Mnet, it was about 1999 going into 2000. And I was one of their presenters, continuity presenters. In sub-Saharan Africa, they could have black and colored presenters presenting Mnet. But post-sub-Saharan Africa, that's your Arabic African countries, they didn't want to see black people on their screens. So all the white presenters would do that part of either the Arabic countries in the Middle East or the Arabic countries in Africa. And it worked for them because then they sold their decoders, and that's, they did what they needed to do to get where they needed to get to. As time went on, obviously that started to shift a little bit. And when we're talking about business, I think it doesn't hurt. I mean, how many, and I think India has done this quite well, especially when they moved into Silicon Valley. What they did is there's a lot of Indian tech companies in Silicon Valley that are actually headed by a white American. And I put that in inverted commas because you see this guy, his name is so-and-so, Jeff, whatever. And actually, the powers that be are an Indian company in India, you know. And now that we're going, oh, but it's okay because the head of Google is actually Indian, we can now just be like, actually, we were Indian all along.
And, that's right.
And
that's
play
right.
the game.
And I think they've expanded and they've bought famous brand companies now because the Indian companies have just grown significantly. I mean, Land Rover is owned
by Tata.
Exactly.
That's so, Land Rover Jaguar, by the way.
Exactly, Land Rover and Jaguar. So every time you're buying a Jaguar, you're not actually buying British anymore. It's actually made it's obviously heralds from the UK, but it's owned now by an Indian business. I think the one thing that the Indians are very good at is exploiting an opportunity and seeing how they can potentially do that. And I think in they understand that in a market like America, it might be a good idea to have an American who is the face of the company and expand in that way.
We were going to go into, and I want to come back to Yasin Bey again at a later stage and also just talk some more about cultural appropriation, but putting into the context of, there are a lot of people out there who are thinking, I want to get out of this corporate milieu and start my own thing. And others are actually, they've sold into the whole, or they've bought into the whole idea of, this is what I want to do. I'm in a corporate environment. And touching on those two things, we had a great conversation the other day, Katesh, where you were saying, there are things to look out for that you must think about very clearly if you're going to go into business. So if you're out there thinking, I want out, I don't want to be at this corporate 9-to-5 anymore, what are some of the things that you should look out for?
I mean, the first thing I think we touched on this morning, it's all about skills. I think the corporate world allows you to first of all, work somewhere, understand how things work, understand how people relate to each other. understand, you know, how you should be communicating, all of that. So the corporate world can be used as a great place for you to build skills. You essentially a place where you can learn. Okay. And I think positioning to leave is first of all, you should have a plan. It shouldn't be this decision that you make. I want to do something completely different. I need to leave.
I hate my boss.
Exactly. And I'm going to jump tomorrow. I think your success is can be tripled if you plan properly. So what do I mean by planning properly? Learn as much as you can, mm-hmm. right? Then ask yourself a question. What I'm doing in my corporate job, can I actually sell this? I mean, the funniest thing is you get somebody who works in compliance of a very specific type of banking operation. Mm. And then they say, well, I'm going to leave and I'm going to become a consultant. And I say, well, what are you going to sell? Because what you've been doing in compliance, there are very few other people who are going to buy that service from you. Actually, the only people that are going to buy it from you are...
the people who are employing you already, right?
Correct.
And so, they're not going to buy it from you as a consultant. They're going to employ you.
And exactly right. And the other thing that you're going to realize is having a professional skill. I don't know about you, but all of us who've been to university, studied something, we are never taught how to sell.
True story.
And no, the right. selling no. is what you need to do. And if you're going to work and you're very successful at whatever you're doing, but if you're not actually involved in selling, I think you're going to get a rude awakening when you move outside, because that's what the role then does. If you start anything on your own, you're going to be selling.
Yeah.
So develop your skill. If you don't have it, use the safety of the comfort of earning a salary and corporate to build a skill that you don't potentially have. The second point I want to make is, and I don't want to be too long-winded, but the second one is really of having a financial plan. And what do I mean about that?
Those guys are boring.
No. The plan is this.
Boring, those guys. Death by financial planners. Death.
No. This is a different kind of plan. This plan literally says, what's my current position? Let me reduce my debt as low as it can go. Let me reduce my expenses to what I really, really need. And you can use the time in corporate to plan this. And that's the one thing. Get your overheads as low as possible. Imagine a guy who's living on 20,000 rand a month. He only has to save 100,000 rand and he'll be able to live for 5 months without a salary. Somebody else who's spending 100,000 rand a month needs to have 500,000 rand to live the same time. So which one is better?
Look, yeah. I say this, Brooklyn, you're probably the only person here who can do that right now.
Correct. The rest of us have overheads.
You
all
can always
those different
move back home with your mom.
Yeah, true story.
And then I want to add two other points to what I think is important is having support at home. Whoever you're living with, your wife, your mother, your parents, they've got to buy into your plan of what you're going to do. Because
like getting out of debt or financial planning?
No, leaving corporate and going and doing something on your own. They normally sit back there and saying...
Having that difficult conversation.
And you're going to say to them, but how... Because if you have parents, most parents are very protective. If you've got a good job at a good brand, they probably want you to stay there.
Yeah.
Don't move.
Why are you going to leave this...
What is this art
position?
Thing you're talking about?
You
what
know,
is art?
At least exactly. you have security.
You can't sell
They're
art.
Paying you every month.
When I grew up, we didn't have this. You're in a great company. Yeah. You can just stay there and grow. Secondly,
and look, you bought yourself a polo.
Correct.
That's always
correct.
The case.
What more do you want? Yeah. And the next thing is your wife is exceptionally important, because you are going to be coming home for those next 5 or 6 months and you're going to have to talk to her on how's it going? Well, it's a bit quiet. There won't be any income this month. I think next month but might be better, because that conversation you are
and
going
you
to have.
You have to be so optimistic right? every month. Like, next month, it's about to happen. It's about to go down.
Correct. And you don't want her saying to you, maybe you must get a job. Every night you come home and she says, maybe you should just go back. Maybe you should. I think if you have that support is critically important. And the other thing is I need to tell everyone this, whoever is in corporate, do not burn your bridges. A lot of times you work in organizations and people have these political squabbles with everybody that they possibly know.
So it's like,
that is unfortunately...
Bye, bitches, I'm out.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah, straight up.
That is your network.
That's what Dumisha does.
Right? So you're going to kill your future network of people.
FYI. So you need a lot of coaching here.
All right.
This guy is like whack like that.
We're going to go to a commercial break. Thanks,
SABC.
Thanks, Mona.
Wherever he goes, he just burns.
I'm going to just shut you down now.
Yeah, shut down. Shut down my mic.
Choice. Sometimes you have it and sometimes you don't. AutoTrader gives you the choice. Now you can shop, compare and buy new cars. Watch our expert video reviews and research before you buy. Auto Trader New Car. The choice is yours.
Keeping it real on CliffCentral.com.
Okay, we're back, and we're still talking about, you know, if you're thinking of getting out there, I don't burn my bridges, Bono, obviously. I just tell them where to get off when I leave.
But Katesh, you need to coach some more, yeah?
But Brooklyn, I mean, you yourself, you're the youngest guy in the room, so you just qualified.
About? I'm the youngest.
You were the youngest, but you're not anymore. You're not the last born anymore. Didn't they teach you that when you went to school? I mean, this is recent.
No, they didn't.
Didn't tell you how to teach you how to sell your skill?
Not really. They taught you your skill, but they didn't teach you how to sell your skill. And I think that's the problem that lots of people my age are struggling with. Is like they have the skill, but they don't know how to sell it.
Would that even be in trying to get a job? Because
yes,
a lot of
exactly.
young people can't even sell the skill to get the job.
Exactly.
It's things like how to put a CV together
exactly.
properly. How absolutely. To go into an interview situation,
yes.
right, Katesh?
Absolutely,
I mean,
right.
Those are the basics of selling yourself. And then
yes.
if you want to sell your skill later on, if you don't have those basics, how are you going to sell the skill?
Absolutely right. I think selling yourself, it's a natural thing. We all have to do it all the time. But I think people don't always look at that as a skill or teach it.
Or willing to learn it themselves.
Willing to learn it. I mean, remember the very basics of going to trying to get a job is how you should dress.
Yeah.
That used to be one of the things. How you should even sit when you are actually waiting for the interview. You don't want to be slouching on the couch. You don't want to be doing things that are inappropriate. Because the guy, whoever's going to interview, is going to walk in. He's already made the decision when he's probably seen you. He's already said, is it positive, negative? There's a positive
first impression.
Energy. The second thing about selling yourself is about being confident, about being able to speak up and being honest about what you've learned and what you have to
but
offer.
But why do people hate sales?
They don't
we
see
do
that.
It every day.
But
you
we
know,
don't
you,
see
you
it.
Even sell
look down on
vegetables.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you sell to your kids every day as parents. Well, those that do have. You convince people that this is my CV, this is what I'm about, and you need me in your organization. Or even to your kids, Katesh, to sell them that they need to eat vegetables because they're healthy for them.
Look, I think with your
we're
kids...
We're selling!
Well, you are selling, but they're not always buying. Let me tell you
spoon.
Something. I think your kids are different because they're not always buying or they're agreeing or being irrational or whatever the scenario is.
Right.
We don't see it actually as selling. And people sometimes, when it comes, almost feel that they're being a little dishonest when you hear the sales word.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they almost
sales
think
pitch.
As sale as being some kind of pitch. You've got to get
sell
an
me
angle.
Some snake oil.
Exactly. You've got to get an angle.
Yeah.
This thing doesn't do what do, but if I can convince you to say yes, 6 times, I've got a sale. There's all these various selling techniques. So we don't actually identify selling as selling yourself. So, I mean, in life, when you are going and you're meeting a girl for a very first time,
you're selling.
You are actually selling yourself.
Yeah.
And if you don't realize you're selling yourself,
that
then
I
you're
am,
dumb.
Then you've missed it.
A lot of that is misrepresentation, isn't it, obviously?
Yeah. Especially on your
especially
side.
Especially since you're a marketer. You're telling people about the product that doesn't exist.
Can
you know?
Can
you're
I be honest
promises.
With you? I've moved from being a marketer to a salesperson.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why.
Tell me why.
Everybody's a marketer these days. Everybody can do events. Everybody can do production, but no one can sell. If you ask someone to go sell, it's a problem. I actually enjoy it, and I realize that whenever I'm going out to try and market a product, I'm actually selling to say, you
so
want this product.
What's the difference then?
There's
basic
a huge difference.
Marketing and selling.
Okay, so let me put it this way. So in a corporate world, right? Katesh, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
Salespeople determine their own salaries. Marketers get a fixed amount to say, well, this is what you get. You're actually a cost to us. So I had to wake up to that phenomenon to say, you know, marketers are often referred to as a cost center as opposed to an income center. So the way they treat marketers and the way they treat salespeople is two different. It's worlds apart.
Yeah.
You know, a salesperson can have a bad week this week, but you know that at least we're heading off to a target. And once we reach this target, we tend to get X amount or incentive driven mindset.
In other words, if I can just jump in there.
Yeah.
Marketing is not necessarily about, there's no target. It's just, I'm going to speak to people about this company
product.
Or this product.
Yeah.
Whereas sales, I'm actually going to get people to buy
correct.
This product. Okay,
correct.
Cool.
So the respect levels are different for me. Salespeople, you know, you can't bullshit your way in sales.
Absolutely. I think the one thing what you're saying there is marketing. You're creating awareness. You're going out. You're building the brand. You're doing all those nice things.
Yeah, all those pretty things that don't
almost position your product for potential sales. The salesperson has to go out and do the actual numbers. He's got to perform. He's got to deliver. It's
exactly.
Very real. You either sold something or you didn't sell something. Very very clear.
Yeah.
If I don't sell anything, I'm not going to get paid a lot of money.
Yes.
If I sell something, I will be paid a lot of money. I firmly believe that. And I'm a chartered accountant by profession. But I still say I would never employ a chartered accountant to sell anything, because we're not taught to do that. And you have to be a special kind of person to go out there, and you've got
to
learn
special.
The value.
So you're special.
Well, I'm not special.
Actually, speak
no,
it up.
No, wait. We're
let's
testing
hear
him
yeah.
on his own theory. Because he was talking about how you've got to say all those things.
Right.
So are you special?
Yeah. I'm not special.
Katesh.
No. So I'm not really special. What I realized very early on in my life, in my career, I had this desire to be independent and do what I wanted to do.
Hmm.
And that's the first time you realize, when you go out there independent, as an independent person, that you realize, if I do not do this, I will not make any money and I won't get paid. The desire for me to stay in business and to be independent was greater than anything
the fear
else.
Of
okay,
not
so let's
exactly.
talk numbers. Paycheck. Let's talk numbers, okay. Mr. CA.
Yes. Hmm. Don't talk about numbers.
If it's money, I'll
yeah,
work it
yeah.
out.
Okay. I got you, dog.
He can work
you.
Out exchange rates.
Yeah.
I'll become rusty now.
Right. It's easier when we talk your own numbers, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So as a qualified CA who can walk into a job practically anywhere, because obviously you match the BE, just don't buy his twang and all that. He's not white. He's black. You know,
he's
brother
Indian
man, Indian.
I am an Indian guy.
He said he's a CA. And you know, a lot of CAs are Indian.
Yeah.
Or Indians.
I was actually going to get to that. Like most people that run the banks are Indian.
Dude,
accountants are Indian.
The people
like
in
they're
the
taught from a
services.
Young age that,
yeah.
that yeah, numbers.
CFOs.
Yes.
Indian.
Why is that, Katesh? Now
we're going somewhere.
I'll answer that question. Why
he has the secret?
He has the secret. Clearly, Indian people have a secret when it comes to numbers.
They do have a secret when it comes to numbers. But
right.
But I mean, the thing is, a lot of Indian emphasis when you're growing up, education wise, is on science and maths. But irrespective of that, a lot of us grew up surrounded by people who ran very simple business operations. And at some point when you're growing up, you stood in an uncle's shop and you served customers. You realize somebody's giving you X and you put it in the cash register and you sell something. And that becomes a natural way. I mean, I grew up on a farm. I remember counting bags of mangoes, which we used to sell every December. And my job was to
mango
make
season.
Packets of 6 and 12.
You had already started accounting.
And,
right?
So
don't put in 7.
They're groomed early, eh?
So you do that. It's a natural thing. You see it around you.
DC
you
numbers
see people
as mangoes.
In business. And you're always thinking of how to... I mean, I grew up always thinking of how can I make an extra rand by trying to sell something to somebody else.
Right.
And that was me naturally growing up.
But didn't you sell when you were in boarding school? Like, you know, you were from the days when there were no Model Cs. You either went to private school or you went to the school in the township.
Correct.
So you were at that private school there and you were selling to the white guys there. What were you selling?
My first starting off is we had this thing called tuck, right?
Yeah.
Everybody goes to boarding school, has this box. And you get to keep packets of chips and whatever you used to have.
Biscuits.
I used to get a lot of tuck. I don't know about you, but every Indian family, there's one thing that's not short of is food. So
yeah.
The biggest fear in my family was I would not have something to eat, and therefore I had to have a lot of tuck to make sure that I had something to snack on if I ever got hungry. I realized that obviously other people didn't have, and they were willing to pay for it. So, and being in a boarding school, you only had tuck shop time certain times of the day.
And if it was out in the sticks, you couldn't
correct.
Just go to the
we
shops.
Correct. We were in Moy River, and the only day you could go down to the shops was on a Friday afternoon. So what would you do the rest of the week? This was an opportunity. So when people got the munchies at about 10 o'clock at night, there I was. And my as far as my pricing was concerned, it was double, triple.
What?
So but you
you're
gotta,
ruthless.
This
you
is
gotta,
where we are today.
You got to understand. There are people at 10 o'clock at night who are hungry, who have a bit of cash. And I said, well,
and you were like, listen, guys, I know that it costs as much at the shop, but in this shop here, this is how much it costs. Otherwise, you can walk.
Absolutely. So in Standard 4, I had two things. I grew on the fear. I started in Standard 4, which is a very early age, about 11 years old. But I did have two things. Mm-hmm. I had a kettle and I had a snack widget machine. So my first business, really, was selling people time to make snack widgets. So they would bring their own thing, put it in my snack widget machine and pay me.
Yes, cashing
the second,
in, fam.
The second one was coffee. I had a kettle. So if they wanted to make, in those days, hot chocolate was a big thing because you just mixed it up with water, right? So my kettle would be selling water.
Because there was no long life milk. So it's not like, you know.
You're in a boarding house.
Yeah. You have hot chocolate with water. And you don't want to have black coffee.
True story.
That's right.
Oh, here's the thing, though.
And I elevated, let me just complete the story. I think I elevated by the time I was in college, or I eventually realized that lending money was a great thing. Because then I didn't have to
financial services.
Level. Correct.
Okay, so level. I need money, Kate. So I need money. So, lots of it.
So this was a spiral. I mean, you had kids in a spiral. They'd
so
borrow
do you still,
from me one
do you
term,
still run your Mashonisa business?
I didn't. But at the time,
okay,
it was
but
the best
now,
thing.
Like you're a CA, you look like you've got money. I need money. So
I'm trying to sell myself. I look like
he's
I've
got
money
that
works.
But here's the thing. I mean, and this is a fundamental question. Because
no, but I'm serious. I need money.
I understand. But here's the thing, right? He's going to loan you money. He knows you. You're his friend. And this is what I want to talk about. And sometimes people make that mistake in business where I have, like, you knew you were making money more than you were making friends.
Yeah.
If you were me or I was you back then, I would have just said, my friends can use the snack witch machine. And if you want to be my friend, then you can also use the snack witch machine. And that's all you get. You're liked. The matrix maybe don't beat you up every 5 days.
Yeah.
But you were like, you know what? Like me or not, you can still like me. But here's the price.
Correct. I mean, look, I think when you're 11 years old, you don't think about those things and you think, well, this is a great idea. I'll just have you know, make 20, 30 cents every single time a person had a cup. I remember it was
something like
5 cents
or something.
No. And it was. And in the end, the money lending business was, if I look back on it now, it literally mimics life today because I had a system. So guys used to stay in the same dorm with me. They were the ones that really did borrow some money. So they I knew where they were. They weren't going anywhere.
Did they have preferential rates?
No. They were
closer to your cubicle.
Well, what we did is I had these IOU notes. So I'd write. They would sign an IOU note with an amount that they would pay back.
Okay? Yeah.
So I would give you 5 rand. You'd give me back 10 rand. So we had these IOU notes. So what happened was the system was very clear.
That your interest was high.
So it was very high. I mean, if you look at it, I didn't have interest. I just said, you get this, I get something
low.
Back. Exactly. So I had this system where all of us used to hand our money to the housemaster. And every Friday, you would go to the housemaster and you'd draw your money out. So
like
garnish
orders.
Correct. So what would happen is all these IOUs, I had a system where at the beginning of the next term, the housemaster used to tally up my IOUs and minus that from whoever deposited their money from
holiday.
So
you don't even have to like strong arm them. You don't have to walk around with a cricket bat.
He had his own bank system.
You basically go to the housemaster. It's all above board. You're like,
correct.
Here is, he signed, as you can see, that's his name. And maybe nowadays, here's his picture on the cell phone.
Yeah,
and that was it.
Correct. So what would happen at the beginning of the term, all of us would come back to the boarding school and we'd have pocket money. So the pocket money would go in, I deduct my IOUs, then I would know that at some point during the term, that person would be short.
Of course, because they start out
correct
short and you start out on...
Exactly.
Stay capitalizing.
So
stay capitalizing. Of capitalist.
So, and there were some guys who did get into financial trouble.
Because they've overspent, right?
Correct, they've overspent.
So now they've got like less than nothing.
Correct. So now the financial trouble guys had another system.
What's that?
And this system is we were in boarding school in those days, you could order stationery as well. So then what I would
say, that.
Well, let's do a little bit of a barter deal. Next time the stationery list comes on, these are the 7 things I would like.
And from your stationery list. So like someone's missing a pencil.
So their parents would be paying the debt effectively.
I remember with those stationery lists, you could even order Parker pens and all sorts of things. I mean, I was ordering fountain pens like it was and just losing them.
Yeah.
And you were making money out of it. I wish I was your friend back in school.
Straight
man.
Up. Straight like, up. I mean, we had the outfitters and the pharmacy and all of that.
Yeah.
So those accounts were generally parents' accounts, right? Mm. So when whoever owed money, we would come to an arrangement. Say, okay, well, you've got an account at the stationery at the outfitters. Well, let's go and I'll take a pair of socks or something. But there was always a way of settling. It was a good system. I mean, at the time,
it was a great system, dude.
The best system.
This is a real system. This is how you make real money.
But what did you realize that when you're in a captured market like that?
Yeah.
That where you could control a lot of the variables.
that you're a monopoly as well.
I was a monopoly in that
and
setup.
No one else was like, maybe I should just compete with this guy. Or you know, by the time that the competition was coming in, you were too big for them. You could
too
squeeze
big.
Them out.
Mafia.
I don't know what happened. I didn't really have many, competition as such. It's just the way it worked.
Did you buy like bigger boys as goons?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Did you have people like working
no,
for you
the
on
system
the ground?
Worked so well, I didn't need that. It was literally
ground level.
I had the housemaster who was policing the situation.
Okay, so there's your goon. The law. Well, that's kind of like the law, right? Wow, this guy. Well, there you if you want to get into business, understand the tax
system.
Don't
speak to Katesh.
Understand the tax system.
Well, look, it is, I think we should be teaching people entrepreneurship. We should be teaching selling skills.
How? Where?
You know, Katesh, how? Let me tell you one of the things which I always look at. I did a project for a company, and we went out to the poverty nodes of South Africa.
Yeah.
They're poverty nodes where the gross domestic product of that area is the grants, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Yet we come up with impressive strategies and saying, well, we're going to create a little community development project here.
Mm.
We're going to train people, give raw materials. But the key component of producing anything, if you're in on a quiet road, is how are you actually going to sell that? And I think if you start off with saying, let's build on how we're actually going to sell, making the product, getting the people we have enough of, we can train that, we can spend money on
that.
But selling it is key. So I would rather say, in some of the rural areas where it's really quiet, where there are projects, government spent millions, and these projects are failing. If you go there and all those products, whatever they're producing, you take away and you simply allow it to be distributed in a better place where there's volume, where there's sales, where there's really a sales push, those projects will all become successful. Because that's really the thing, is it's something producing a product.
But
it's another thing getting it to market and selling it. And selling it is key.
What you're saying now is the, business 101. You can't sell something that you are not emotionally invested to, even in terms of, I just want to make money from it. So when we are offering people funding and grants and that sort of thing, and not teaching them about harnessing a market, doing sales, everybody is going to open a bakery because that's what the government's pushing right now. Or a mill, because in this area they make maize.
Or so agriculture. The government is putting agriculture. And I don't know about you, but I always look at my own veggie garden at my house that my wife loves and does.
Are you selling those goods?
And I'm not. But the thing is, I can't grow anything of significance because it's so hard.
It's hard
and yet
work.
Yet, if you try and do that, you try and grow something, you will see you get weeds, you will see you get bugs, you get all sorts of things. Now, if I say, is that our strategy to build agriculture somewhere else? You know how tough that actually is. It's a lot harder than when you're making a product and you're selling it.
Mm.
Agriculture or things like that is that you have one bad year of drought. That enterprise
is gone.
It's gone.
Yeah.
And for it
They've
to revive itself is a lot more difficult than a downturn if somebody was making lamps.
Yeah,
because you can still store the lamps. And the other thing is, I go to these agricultural or rural nodes. If you go to Venda, you'll just see everyone is selling avocados, mangoes, and bananas on the side of the road. So even there, the problem is getting your product out to a market that's more urban, that has more people in it, seems to be a problem. They're relying on passerbys that are going back to the urban areas.
Oversaturation.
So now you have to have a distribution and logistics arm of your business and make sure that you get that product out there as soon as possible before it starts to go off. And that's my thing, right? And what you just said now, is that the places where we should start industrializing, maybe creating manufacturing concerns there that I guess are more organic, biodegradable, call it what you want. So in areas where they have a lot of wood and that sort of thing, why not create something that you can
Katesh, can I
have
come
boards,
in there? Can
maybe?
I come
yeah,
in
go
you
for
know,
it.
Sure.
Last week I attended an event by Shivers.
Okay.
And it's called The Venture, right?
Very
so
nice.
They've got judges, right? Mm. I won't mention their names, but they've got...
It's like another Dragon's Den.
There we go. They've got Lebo Kunguluza.
Oh, Lord. Where we just have people who are like...
Hang on.
They say they're business people. Sorry. Go on.
They say, yes. Mm. Yes, yes,
they
yes.
Say.
We won't go there.
No, let's not.
But if you want to go there, I won't stop you.
I ain't going there. You go
So
there.
They've got Lebo Kunguluza. They've got Tolisa Kyeshana.
Mm-hmm.
They've got...
Tolisa's from advertising.
Yeah, and they've got
Joe
the guy read more books.
Now you see.
What's his name again? the guy who dared you to read a book a week.
Teboho.
Teboho.
Yeah.
Teboho Ditshego. Yes, they've got Teboho. They've got.
He was good though.
They've got a lady from WITS who lectures on entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
And she's been in the CSI space for a minute, for like 15 years. And then they've got some. Now they've got Fix.
Fix was a DJ on 5FM.
Yes, Fix runs this thing taking kids to school, and I don't know how she does, but anyway, she's got.
So you present to these guys your amazing idea.
Yeah, so they take applications from around the country, and then the top 5 or top 10 go in, and they go in front of this panel. And the guys who've won, effective, like for me, last year, so there was a group of youngsters. Their company was 3 months old.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And they developed something or a system that you can put on the ground that could detect fires within shacks.
Okay.
Right.
So that's a good product.
You know, so that was effectively. So it would be able to withhold the heat from primastoffs and all those things, but detect a main fire.
Okay.
So it would give a warning bell to, like, you know, the fire department.
Yes.
And then this year, there's a guy. His story is eluding me, but he developed something that when you're in a car accident, your crash. It's a crash application.
Okay.
So when your phone gets stolen, you know how things go missing in an accident scene. Yeah. It's already sent out a message to a hospital or to your medical aid that you've been in an accident.
Yes.
And they should come. So by the time that phone gets stolen, you've already got medical help.
Okay.
So my thing is, back to that appropriation, when do we give, like, kids in townships, like, time to develop these things? Because they don't have the resources to think on these things. So how do we, like, you're saying we must teach entrepreneurship and all those great things. Where do we start? And what does it look like teaching someone entrepreneurship? Because you have just also said now that, like, you got firsthand. 6 mangoes, 12 mangoes. 6 mangoes, 12 mangoes. You had a kettle. You were given tools to be resourceful.
Yeah.
Now, how do we start it when people don't even get to this point?
There's no role models. I think in those setups, because people who they look up to, your parents and whoever else. Yeah. And I've benefited from the fact that you've grown up a couple of generations in South Africa and I've grown up with the heritage of wherever Indian people have gone, they have traded. Wherever. Yeah. You can count any country in the world, you will find us trading something.
Yeah.
Because that is the quickest way to make a living if you land. So I often joke about it. You were joking about what if you land up in London. If you land up in London, you'll try and get a corner somewhere and maybe sell coffee. I don't know.
We're talking about Tanzania.
So I think in the township scenario, the role models are not there. The second part is perhaps schooling can play a role, because you can introduce some of these topics and people start thinking. And I think information is readily available now. With the fact that you've got technology, with the fact that you've got people with phones, you can access it. But you've got to plant the seed of the possibility of there's another world, this is how it works. One of the other things you do is what they're doing now is arrange events in townships where people actually participate in mini markets, and it's got to be youth driven.
Yeah.
So try and maybe have workshops in school where you say, well, let's think of 3 things that in our school we're going to have 4 stands at this event. And it must be another event. It must be an event that's going to attract crowds. So let's assume a big match or something is happening. Let's attach this outside. Let's create a little bit of an atmosphere, and then have it driven by kids who man 4 stands each from different schools. And that then allows you to say, well, what are you doing? And that becomes a little bit of a project. Okay, you're going to be selling juice. Let's think this through. What is it going to cost you? How much are we going to sell it for? How much money are you going to make? I think if you can get that spark in somebody's eye to see that I've spent 1 rand and I've sold it for 2 and I've made 1 rand profit, that making of the 1 rand profit is the motive, is the spark, is the magic. And that's what you've got to do practically.
I think, in closing, because we have to go now, the thing is, when you said the role models in townships, growing up, my thing of traders was guys who were hawkers, right? And my thing was, I'll never be a hawker.
There's nothing cool about that.
I've never seen any hawker go from I've been he was a hawker and now he has a big business.
Yeah.
And maybe that was just the political situation back then.
No, you're right.
No, but it was, if you think about it, it was politicized because a lot of hawkers, one day they'd be at the bus stop and then the police would come and burn their stuff.
Yeah.
Yes. And they're always starting again, right? As a, and obviously, just to get a license or to be able to buy that shop or to rent that shop was always difficult.
Yes.
So even that mental side of the township, people say we must stop talking about apartheid because it's over. It's not
over. It's not over.
The mental side of it, we forget what it's done to us because, like you said, the natural growth would be someone goes from being a hawker, they sell enough, they make enough profit, they're allowed to actually survive and make enough money, and then they're allowed to buy into a larger system. Whereas growing up, they weren't. If anything, every other month, they had to start over again because their stuff was systematically destroyed by the system.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then when they got to a point where they're making too much money, they really couldn't even get a license to rent a shop. They weren't allowed to buy product to sell and things like that. So it's about saying, guys, it's not the same scenario anymore.
No.
Yeah.
It's different and it's new because actually, the reason why those things were happening back then, like you said, I've never seen a cool hawker growing up.
No.
But the reason why that happened is so that you would stop thinking of business as being cool and making your own money and being free as being cool. So actually, let's turn that around and say, actually, you can start that system. But how do you get from being a hawker then to being an actual real business?
I've seen success factors here. I must admit, I the one thing I did when I was studying is I got a hawker's license for Joburg. And I was on Ilof Street and I used to hang up my few items that I bought from people I knew, and it's interesting. I think that experience of being out there in the street and trying to sell someone is worth a lot. So the idea about getting from a hawker to something bigger is the ability to save a little bit of money and grow. I think what happens with a lot of the hawkers is whatever they make, they use.
Yeah.
And that puts you in a vulnerable position. Yeah. And the other thing,
it's hand to mouth.
So if you're making a little bit more, right, then you could grow. And I've seen people grow.
Yeah.
I've seen people grow from being on there's
the street,
one person that I remember, and his name is Lucky. And he was lucky because he started off buying products as a hawker and moved into formalized business and now has a chain of stores.
Just on that note to close it.
Yeah, Mani, I have to ask these youngsters, I mean, what is it that propels you guys? Because we've never been exposed to like internet stuff, you know. Now they're digital marketers and all that.
Yeah.
Like, what drives you guys? And I'm now blanket approaching, but you can speak from your own story.
Well, personally, it was that case of seeing all of these hawkers and not seeing them progress. Why aren't they progressing? Yes. How can I progress? Even in my field. Like, cool, I was like born into the internet, but how can I make a living from it? So even if you're born into that entrepreneurship kind of lifestyle, how can you make it more than what it actually is to you? And that was my drive. It's just like, cool, this is who I am, but I want to go further. I don't want to be at this level all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think in closing with what Kotesha said as well,
yeah.
is he said he got a hawker's license.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, when we go into business, the fundamentals of admin, we don't quite do in terms of get that license so that when the cops come, they don't close you down, right?
Correct.
Make sure that you get your tax clearance certificate if you've just started a business. Make sure that admin-wise, you've got all the things that you need. And that might be a personal investment in your own business because no one's going to give you that money to get started. A lot of people go out there looking for funding and the guys in funding are going, okay, well, are you registered? No, I haven't registered. Have you got a bank account? No, I haven't got a bank account. So do those things and then save a little bit once you start working.
And we got to go.
We got to go.
Peace.
Bye.
See you next week.
This is CliffCentral.com.